Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm your host, Elsheree Gladden. I'm USA Today bestselling author with over 30 published novels, and I'm also a ninth grade English teacher. And on this week's episode, I am going to be talking to David Myshen today with his book recently published with University of New Mexico Press, and it is called Nopalito, Texas, Stories. So David, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Well, I'm a native Texan. I grew up inland of Corpus Christi on a farm. I was raised in the 50s and 60s on a very small farm. I was a high school English teacher by way of career. I've wanted to be a writer of fiction my whole life, and so now I am a published writer of fiction. I've been writing poetry for, goodness, probably more than half my life, since my mid-30s, and now fiction. I live in New Mexico. I'm married. My husband, Scott Wiggerman, here with me. We moved here from Austin, Texas, 9 years ago. So here we are.
I'm glad to have you and glad to have you in the state as well. I'm glad you made the connection with UNM Press.
Delighted to be published by UNM Press.
How have you found that experience? Pretty much all the authors I've talked to from them have enjoyed the process. I know they have a pretty extensive process of bringing an author on board. It sounds like it goes through a couple of rounds of readers and review before they make an offer of a contract to someone. So is that something you've experienced before through your poetry, or how has that been in comparison?
Yeah, for me, this was a unique experience, and I think it's because it's a university press. I have been delighted with UNM Press, partly because it's right here, partly because I already knew Lynn and Linda Miller, who founded this Southwest fiction series that Nopalito is part of. I had socially met the acquisitions editor who I worked with, so I felt like I knew some of these people already. It's very professional, and I will tell you, the reason it's unique, if you work with a university press, the editors ordinarily are not allowed to just decide they're going to publish something. So with a fiction series or a poetry series, if the editors are interested in a particular volume, it has to be reviewed by, quote, outside experts. So in my case, they sent the manuscript to three different fiction writers, and it does add a time element to being published by a university press, but this is something I was aware of, and for me, I enjoyed the whole process. The reviewers actually made suggestions for revisions that really improved what I had, so it worked out very well for me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's always interesting to hear people's different publishing experiences, especially across different genres, because that can be quite different between poetry or nonfiction or memoir or short story collections. So that's really neat
right. That
they still have that extensive process, not just for the academic writing, but through fiction. I think it's nice as a reader to have that steady quality that you can count on.
Right. Well, and as a writer, I felt affirmed knowing that the manuscript had been reviewed, and I was grateful to the reviewers who suggested, they were fairly minor, but they suggested revisions that I think improved what I had, and I felt good about knowing that the manuscript had been reviewed in that way. I felt like, well, it's ready to go then.
So interesting. One of my early publishing experiences it was a small press, and I remember getting the contract, signing it, and then kind of going a couple months without hearing anything. And I was like, is this with the editor, or where are we at in this process? And they were actually like, oh, yeah, it seemed fine. So we sent it on to the formatter. I was like,
good heavens.
Yeah, it was not fine.
Right. I would want to be in that process. I wouldn't want it to just suddenly be with the formatter.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. And after I got my rights back, I had to go back through the whole thing and correct a lot of stuff.
So right,
it's
right,
nice that when that doesn't happen. Well, let's give the readers an idea of what we're talking about, because Nopalito, Texas, this was a really fascinating collection. It's short stories, but they're all connected. So tell us what the book is, and then we'll dive into the process and the stories and everything after that.
Okay, it's Nopalito is a small town. It's fictional in South Texas. It's about 100 miles due south of San Antonio. I actually got out a map and chose a location so I could picture where it is while I was writing. As a collection, it kind of grew organically. The story that started it begins with a man who finds his son's glasses in a creek bottom. And the question for me is, who was that son? Who is this father? What happened? And so I ended up with a father and a son. The father has two other children. There's a wife. These people began to fascinate me. And at the time when I started this, I was in an MFA program at Texas State in San Marcos, Texas. So I was focusing on writing short stories. And so each time during that period of years where it was time for me to work on another story, another character would suggest himself or herself. And at some point, I realized that I had a community going, that there was some overlap. And at some point during that process, I began to think of it as a collection. I will tell you that I was actually calling it a novel in stories, but two of the reviewers said, these are really strong stories. They are linked stories. There's a real strong sense of these characters in a community, but they didn't think it had the arc of a novel. And my response was, I don't really care what you call it. It doesn't need to be called a novel in stories. So it kind of grew organically out of my interest in a place like that and these characters who would sometimes, I felt like a character was raising his hand or her hand and saying, I'm interesting, write about me. That's how it happened over a period of years, really.
Well, that's really fascinating. I loved the organization of this. At the beginning of each story, you tell when it's taking place and the main person involved, which helps orient you in this town. And I've noticed with some of the books that I've gotten recently, short story collections, the polyphonic novels, these kind of different types of structures have been popping up more recently. And this, even right, within some of the different types of structures I've been seeing lately, this still had its own unique quality to it. Some of the characters occur in multiple stories. You're getting a sense of the history of the place through its people. And that is interesting. So I'm thinking in my own mind and reaction to this being called a novel in stories or a collection of short stories. And I'm kind of on the fence on that because it doesn't have a traditional novel arc, you know, if we're talking three-act structure, that type of thing. But it really still is telling an overall story of place while giving the shorter stories of the people in that place.
I'm glad to hear you say that, and I will tell you, one of my good friends who was my professor and thesis advisor when I was doing the MFA in fiction writing, when I reached out to her, she said, call it linked stories, let them call it stories. She said, you're better off if you have a collection that's called stories, and if you have readers get to the end of it and say, this kind of felt like a novel. She said, that's working for you. But she said, if it's called a novel in stories, what if you have readers who get to the end of it and say, well, I liked it and it's stories, but it doesn't feel like a novel. And as I said, it didn't matter to me for them to call it linked stories. I was just so happy to have University of New Mexico Press say yes. And I worked with amazing people there to bring it to publication. So I'm delighted.
Well, and I think that makes a great point of the reader expectations. So that's something
right,
we always need to consider even when we're writing for ourselves. We're still, if we're planning to put it out into the world, thinking about that reader reaction and what they're expecting. I really like that argument, and I think that's a great point to be made. But either way, like you said, whatever it's called, It was a wonderful grouping of stories. And I did notice that one of the author recommendations in the front compared your level of writing and depth of storytelling within these short glimpses into these characters' lives. She compared that to Alice Munro, who recently passed away, and the New York Times did a wonderful obituary and review of her work.
Alice Munro was an amazing writer of short stories. I've admired her for a long time, and having that blurb writer say, like Alice Munro, was a huge compliment to me. I love what her stories do, and I love this notion that my stories here have something in common with what she's doing. It just made me feel good to see that.
I imagine. It set the tone because I did read those before I started in reading the rest of it. So I was kind of like, that's quite the comparison. So I was prepared really for some some depth, and I was not disappointed. I struggle with writing short form anything, really, even when I was working more actively in journalism. It's like, why is this 30 inches? Sorry.
Right.
I will try to cut it down. So I have a hard time with the short form because, I don't know, I just have a hard time packing everything into so few words. But that was something that struck me with your stories, was how much you learn about the characters, how many layers are peeled back in each story, and the complexity of your characters. Because in some of the stories, there is a lot that happens. And in some stories, there's not a lot of traditionally labeled events so much. But no matter what was going on in the story or how many pages it covered, I finished each one and felt like I really knew that character and I could sympathize with them and feel that there's a lot of emotion in all of your stories. And to be able to make those connections and pack so much of that into each short story really stuck with me as I was reading, and it was hard to put down.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. One of the challenges for me, and I could give you two examples, the character that opens with a man finding his son's glasses, and this man, he has done some fairly, maybe the wrong word is brutal, but there has been bad blood between him and his son. And my challenge with Ed, with this character, was he is a man who has made some poor decisions and done some things that I don't admire, but where is the humanity in him? How do you write that kind of story so that, because I'm not interested in a collection of short stories where I like every character from first page to last. I want more complexity in them. And it's been an interesting challenge for me with these characters.
Well, that is something I wanted to ask you about, because pretty much all of the characters in here, they really have a lot of sides to them. There's no one who's just all good, all bad, stereotypical. There's just none of that. And one of the ones that I think I really felt that with the most, let me find it here, A Husband to Barry, where we're looking at Candace Lambert Grant. And this one, Candace had been in a previous story in the book, and so we're kind of seeing her for the second time in this next chapter of her life. And she was such an interesting character to follow, because there's a lot of areas where you sympathize with her, but then there are some other areas where she's really struggling to feel connected to her life and the people in it, that is hard. It's hard to read, and in a good way, but that duality of her character, where it's like you understand what she's going through, you understand the disappointments and the life she's in a lot of ways been forced into and what that does to a person. And then there's still some of those aspects where you're like, oh, but.
I'm glad you mentioned her. Candace, I started with Candace, the earlier story. All I knew is that I had a girl standing on a bridge waiting for a boy, and they were going to go down into this creek, and I thought she was going to end up being pregnant from just this one time in the creek. And as I worked on it, initially, the challenge was I don't think I like this girl, but I'm not willing to write a story. I'm not willing to stick with a character if all I can think is, well, I don't like her. She just got more and more interesting to me. And once she makes a foolish mistake, she's going to have to live with the consequences of that mistake. And so, like in the story you mentioned in A Husband to Bury, she's trapped in this marriage. She doesn't want to be there. She doesn't want to be pregnant. She doesn't want to have a child. And yet she's going to. And I felt like there were moments where you want to tell her, snap out of it, wake up. But she interested me in that way. I felt like I kept letting Candace be Candace until my fascination won out over any kind of judgment. Yes, she's done foolish things, but I also got sympathy for her in understanding that even if she made the mistake that's got her trapped, the emotional toll that takes on her, feeling trapped, the depression, the isolation, etc., just made her a really interesting character to me.
Absolutely. Well, and a lot of what comes into play, most of your stories are set in the 50s and 60s time period. And it was really interesting to see the different social aspects of that time and the things that are different, but a lot of the things that are still the same today. Women have more options. Well, in some cases, some of those options have been changing and going backward. But in this time period, a lot of these characters are in situations or make choices, and then their ability to deal with those situations and choices are often very limited because of the time period they're in. You bring up depression, the pregnancy, a lot of things that, like, today you could go to a doctor and say, this is what I'm experiencing. Say, okay, yeah, you're really struggling with some depression and anxiety. Here's what we can do to help. And in that time period, in the earlier story with, I'd have to find it, the mom, her youngest goes off to school and she's just overcome by the silence of her house. And, you know, I'm reading it today thinking, oh, this poor woman, like, she needs some medical care to deal with what she's going through. And her family has no clue what's going on, no sympathy for it in a lot of cases. And the husband and the children are just like, what's wrong with you?
Right. Well, and there's no, and she feels alone and she doesn't understand that there are probably other women in this community who experience the same kind of isolation when their children get to school and they're alone at home. And it's one of the things that struck me about these characters and about a place like that. People don't reach out because they're afraid to. They're afraid to be judged. They feel like no one else is having that kind of whatever the problem is. And so it makes things that much harder for them. And like in the case of this woman, Doreen, I sympathize with her husband. He's got a lot of hard work and he feels like, get over yourself. We don't have time for this. Her mother, I almost laughed out loud because her mother just said this before I could even write it down. When her mother says, what's wrong with you? And Doreen says, I got the blues. And her mother says, you don't have time for the blues. And her mother is right. She doesn't have time for the blues. But that doesn't save Doreen from feeling depressed. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. That seems to be a theme that comes up several times of just that aloneness in this time period, particularly, you know, these young women who end up in situations that they don't know how to deal with. They can't talk to anyone. They can't tell anyone. You have the little boy in the yellow dress who is clearly fascinated with fashion and his mother's clothing, and he has different characteristics than his brothers, and they're making fun of him. And he can't share any of that with anyone. He knows his dad won't understand. And he also seems to understand, even at younger ages, like, that's very dangerous in that time period for anyone to think you lean toward.
It is, and I will tell you, I was a child in the 50s and 60s on a small farm in South Texas, a very small community. And I was raised by parents who loved each other and loved their children. But I mean, we didn't have words for it, but I'm gay. I mean, I was gay. There just weren't the words for it. But you could sense that there was danger in that, that these were things that, like, you could not say these things about yourself to anyone. You could not seek help from, you know, aunts, uncles, parents, grandparents, siblings. And I don't know how that was conveyed, but you knew it. I think anything that was out of the norm in places like that, you felt that there was danger in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of those things are so subtly passed on to the next generation that as young people growing up, you don't see it overtly often. I mean, definitely in some situations, those messages are very clear. But like you were saying, even in, I think, today's culture, there are a lot of things that are very politically charged or linked to religion or social class, whatever it is, that we grow up knowing what is and isn't okay and what the reactions are going to be. And even if you can't really pinpoint it, it's there and we understand it. And it was really interesting to see some of the lights turn on with my students this semester. We did The House on Mango Street and we were talking about gender roles and how we learn gender roles as we grow up. And at the beginning of the unit, a lot of them were like, I haven't experienced any of this. I don't know. And I was like, no, you have. You've experienced all these same things. You just haven't noticed. And watching them kind of be like, oh, wait, yeah, I do know what, you know, girls are supposed to wear or what chores are expected of the genders in my family and different things like that, where they hadn't stopped to really think about it yet, but they knew the answers. Right. And I think that was interesting to see that played out in a lot of ways in your stories with what is and isn't proper, what you can and can't do, and what are going to be the social consequences of breaking those rules.
Right, right.
And I wanted to ask your development of your characters. This is probably a big question that doesn't have an easy answer, but what is your approach for developing these interesting, complex characters in short story form? Do you have a process you use consistently, or is it an organic something that develops differently in each situation?
I think it develops differently. Sometimes, I mean, often a story starts for me with an image, with a what if, with a particular moment. Like everything I learned about Candace, everything that happened with her character development started with her standing on this bridge at night, and she's got out of her parents' house and she's going to meet this boy. And I didn't know who this girl was. I knew she was going to meet a boy. And so it's asking myself questions, putting characters in the same room, like when, I mean, names, I don't remember exactly how names come to me, but I've got a dictionary of names on my shelf here, so I'm regularly paging through looking for names that sound right to me. And Buddy sounded right for the boy who shows up. And so once I got him in this hopped up 1958 Chevrolet, pulling up to this bridge and getting out of this car and got them talking, I began to get a sense of like who he is, who she is, and things develop from there. And the stories frequently turn out to be longer than I imagined them to be. It's that kind of a process of getting characters in a situation, getting them talking, getting them reacting to each other, and asking myself, who are these people? And in the case of Ed and Grady, what happened between the father and the son? and letting that kind of come to me. I don't know if that really answers the question very well. I don't map out a story. I let it begin, and then sometimes there's some, like, kind of some mental mapping, or it will occur to me that there might be some backstory. Maybe I'll have a flashback to something previous that helps explain a character. But it's kind of an organic thing with each story that I let the puzzle pieces fall into place a little bit at a time.
I love that. I think that is such an interesting journey to go on with your characters. I tend to be a little bit more of a pantser and just starting with a random idea and going for it. So I understand that process. But right. it gives you some really interesting, surprising results at times.
Right.
Well, and David, I just noticed we are already out of time, so we need to wrap up. I had so much about this that we could spend talking about, but I will go ahead and get things wrapped up here. But before we sign off, I did want to ask you, what can readers expect from you next, and where can they find you online to keep up with your work and your projects?
Well, thank you for asking that. I have a website that is in need of updating. It's meischeninc.com, and that's all lowercase, last name, and the word I-N-K. So meischeninc.com. It's in need of some updating. I'm on Facebook, so there's some information about me there. In terms of what's coming, I have a brand new book of poetry just out. This would be at my website, too. It's called Caliche Road Poems, and this is out of Lamar University Literary Press. So these books both came out in this spring. I have plans for more poems, more stories. There's kind of the seed of a novel in my head, but it might be a couple of years before I get to it. I also have a memoir that I'm planning to submit, but I don't know where that's going, and sometimes these things can take a long time. For at least the next year, I'm going to be doing as many readings as I can with Nopalito and as many readings as I can with Caliche Road Poems. And so it's not that I'm not writing, but I'm not thinking about what am I publishing next. I'm thinking about doing as much as I can with these two books that I have out there.
A lot of writing and publishing is kind of going through those phases of the writing, the process, the marketing, and over again and mixing them up all over. So I hope you enjoy getting out there and chatting with your readers and getting to know them.
I'm having a wonderful time. A wonderful time.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you again, David, and remind our listeners, the book is called Nopalito, Texas Stories, and that is by David Meischen. And it's available just about everywhere I looked, so I really hope people take a minute to go check it out. I really enjoyed it. These are some fascinating, wonderfully complex characters.
Thank you.